welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and this is episode number 215 of the podcast, and today is 21st of April 2015. I'm kind of scared that it's almost May already, but at least it's a lovely sunny day in London and the blossom is out on the common and all is right with the world, and of course I'm in my basement flat talking to you guys. So thank you listeners for showing up again. So today I have a great interview with Ros Morris, who's been on the show a couple of times now, and we always have a great conversation. I know many of you have read her Nail Your Novel series of fantastic books for writers. Today we're talking specifically about plot, which is exciting, but first quite a bit to update you on. So let's get into that and some useful stuff as well. So first of all, I'm going through the end of my rebranding, my recovering and retitling of the first three of my novels. So Pentecost is now Stone of Fire, Prophecy is now Crypt of Bone, and Exodus is Ark of Blood. Very resonant titles and fantastic new covers, and I'm really happy with the whole rebranding exercise. I'll be blogging soon about the whole process in the next sort of week, so before May. But essentially, a lot of people are obviously asking me why I've done this. These were the first three of my novels, and I really believe that it takes a while for an author, a fiction author, to find their voice. And when I wrote those books, I didn't know what I was doing in terms of titles, author branding. I didn't know what I was doing with the series. I didn't really get a sense of where I was going with my fiction. And the Arcane series is now at 7 books, and certainly the last couple I've really, like Day of the Vikings, Gates of Hell and One Day in New York, I've really felt like, yeah, I know what I'm doing with this series, and I've got more coming. You know, my readers say that Morgan Sierra is a sort of female Indiana Jones, which is cool, and I feel like that's the right kind of branding. And another reason is that the original titles, Pentecost, Prophecy and Exodus, have a kind of religious tone to them. They're religious words. Now, I have a master's in theology, and I'm fascinated by religion and the psychology of religion in particular, but I'm not religious. I'm not Christian. I'm not any religion. I consider myself spiritual, but I'm very interested in the spiritual and supernatural and all kind of religious religions, I guess, and especially the history and all the stuff that goes behind it. So all my books have that kind of aspect, but they are not Christian books or religious books. They're kind of Dan Brown style religion, which is not religious at all, although I think I'm less offensive. I try and be respectful. But the point is that they are mainly kick-ass action adventure thrillers. So the point was to look more mainstream and see how it goes. So you can check out the covers on either of my websites. You can check out jfpen.com and see them there, or on Amazon or Kobo or any of the other sites. They are all there. Okay, so the other thing, I guess, is I've also got a new agent and we are pursuing foreign rights deals, and it's important that the new titles and the covers give the right impression for the series. So, for example, we had a query from a Christian publisher in Brazil, and it's very important to me that I don't give the wrong impression of the books. So that's kind of why, and I will be talking about the practicality, but essentially it's just not a big deal for ebooks. All the sites have fields where you can change the title, change the cover, change the description, you just upload new versions. And I say you just upload, I've spent a number of days uploading new versions, because of course I have to update all the other books with the back matter related to these books, so it's all go. Okay, Oh, and I should say, if you would like to read these books, these three books, Stone of Fire, Crypt of Bone and Ark of Blood, I do have a box set and of those books, and I'm looking to get reviews on that box set. So now is a really good time to email me if you would like a review copy of that box set or any of my books. Actually, I'm always happy to give review copies at joanna@thecreativepen.com. Okay. So the last week has also been nutty around London Book Fair and also Indie Recon. And it was interesting to compare London Book Fair and the level of knowledge of authors at the book fair to the level of the questions from authors at Indie Recon. So Indie Recon is a sort of has people at all levels, but the questions were sort of how do we market audiobooks, or questions around branding and that type of thing. And at the London Book Fair, it was very much basic 101 questions. Why should I self-publish, and how do I get an agent and things like that. So it really made me think about how far we've come as an indie community, and you should all give yourselves a pat on the back for understanding a lot of this stuff. When I speak these days, I realise that we often talk in language that some people don't understand. You know, I might say KDP and you guys would know what that is, but if I say KDP to a group of people who've never self-published or haven't really looked into it, they wouldn't understand what that is. So it's a fascinating time, and I often think, I know I'm running ahead with virtual reality and all this type of stuff, although there was actually a session about virtual reality at the book fair, so it does show that it's getting more mainstream. But it is interesting, there has been a survey in the last couple of weeks called AuthorSay, #AuthorSay, and you can find the survey results at agenthunter.co.uk. It was a survey, of the people surveyed, 90% were traditionally published, and what was interesting, most authors were happy with their agents and the publisher's editorial, but they had serious doubts about the publisher's marketing ability. They never get asked for their opinion and experience poor communication, are poorly paid and poorly treated. Yet for all those problems, 40% said they'd be horrified to self-publish. And it was funny because I think that also shows you the difference in experience and knowledge of most authors in the community. There's also been a survey in The Guardian, it just came out yesterday, 20th of April, median earnings of professional authors fall below the minimum wage. It's fascinating to me that essentially with my income, I'm making more money than 90% of professional authors in the UK. And I'm not one of the I'm not making stacks and stacks of cash as Mark Dawson, who is in Forbes this week, brilliant article, I'll link to it in the show notes. It's so fascinating that there's this dichotomy between an author community who only see the negatives and who can't really grasp that you can make a living with this. And then those of us who have spent a number of years now kind of learning this business. The headline in Forbes, and you can look it up, it was published 17th of April 2015. The headline is Amazon pays $450,000 a year to this self-published writer, and goes into Mark Dawson's success. Mark is a friend of mine, great thriller writer, works incredibly hard, and has written some brilliant books. And I should also point out Mark has and I'm going to have Mark on the podcast in a month or so's time, but he has some great videos on using Facebook for advertising, buyer beware and all that. But you can get those free videos at selfpublishingformula.com. And that's brilliant. But I think it's just been a week of sort of, I live in one world and these other authors live in this other world. So anyway, my big takeaway has been, one, we know more than we think we know. And at the end of the day, it just comes down to writing great books and then learning all this other stuff to help make a living, if that's what you want. I think it's important to remember not everybody does want to make a living with their writing. Oh, right. What else? I would also say, just back on my agent, and London Book Fair, I went to a session on producers and TV agents and things. And it was fascinating because they said they don't have enough product to adapt or enough product to make TV shows and films and things about. And I'll be interviewing Lucy Hay about screenwriting and adapting books. So I hope you'll return for that, because it was an awesome chat. I've actually just come off the phone with her now, and it makes you realise why books don't get picked up for TV and stuff. Anyway, we'll get to that next week. Other exciting things. So the Amazon Kindle textbook creator now lets you embed audio and video, which is very cool and presumably something that will spread to kids' ebook creator. And we had that interview in January with Laura Backus about that technology. So this could be the real game changer for kids' books. Very exciting move. Also makes me think about adding video to segments of my own nonfiction, like, a video about some aspect of marketing embedded in How to Market a Book. Certainly something to look at if you write nonfiction, kids' books, textbooks, whatever. I think that's fascinating. Not something I'm interested in with fiction, to be honest, at the moment, but it's interesting and potentially makes Kindle Fire more equal to iBooks, Author, and Apple devices and that type of thing. Another cool thing, which is kind of a plugin for the KDP dashboard, and that is getbookreport.com, which makes it very easy to view lovely graphs without handing over your Amazon logon. And so basically you download a sort of bookmarklet at getbookreport.com, you log into your Amazon screen, you click this little button, and it turns your sales data into really awesome graphs, and you can kind of look at your earnings through multiple views. Particularly useful, obviously, if you have quite a few books, and it's free for 30 days and then it's $10 a month, so really worth looking at regardless of how many books you have, and then potentially getting the premium version if it's useful. Also, Goodreads has started using audio samples on the site. So that's only just started up, so I imagine it will expand. Another example of audio taking over the world. And there were lots of questions about audio at Indie Recon. I think everyone's starting to get into it. So that is excellent. I'm really glad because I do believe that audio is going to be awesome Apple CarPlay, Google Auto, and, you know, the wider dissemination of smartphones, podcasting and audiobooks are only going to continue to get better. Okay, this podcast episode is sponsored by 99designs. A brilliant book cover will help you stand out in the market, and you can also get matching logo, business cards, website design, packaging design, merchandise, bookmarks, or other things that will help you get your work out there. And remember, if you don't like your book covers or you don't think they're quite right, you can always change them, as I have been doing, as I've just done with my own books. And we also adjusted the font of Gates of Hell to match the new covers. And I actually used 99designs myself for a custom illustration of the key to the Gates of Hell, which features on the book cover and inside the print book as a motif. And it looks stunning and actually drove the description in the book. So I got to borrow some creative brains during the writing process. Now, there's no risk with 99designs, as you only pay when you're happy with what is created, and you get lots of choice with multiple designers submitting work. Now, you can get a power pack upgrade, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed, with bold headers, highlighted background, and featured listing by going to 99designs.com/Joanna. That's Joanna. So 99designs.com/Joanna. This corporate sponsorship pays for the hosting, but my time in producing the show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. You make me very happy every time I do a podcast. It actually means a lot to me when people support on Patreon, because it's like I have names to put to listeners, and that's it's It's lovely. I'm going to cry. But anyway, thanks in particular to Parker Hudson, Samantha Lucas, A.D. Davis, Stevie Puckett, Moralva Guzmao, and Doug Salter. And Parker Hudson, is also the first listener that I've heard from who listens to the show underwater while he does his regular swimming exercise. So if you fancy listening while swimming, Parker recommends underwateraudio.com, which is brilliant. And I love, so I'm like, hi Parker, you know, when I think about what people are doing. I mean, people often put on Twitter and things that they listen at the gym or when they're exercising or when they're ironing. This is the first time I've had swimming. If you're doing something else while listening to the podcast, please tweet me, thecreativefen.com. Very cool. So on Patreon, you can support me with a few dollars or even just $1 per show to a maximum of 2 shows a month, so less than a coffee a month. You can support the show at patreon.com/thecreativepen. That's patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much. Now let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and today I'm here with Roz Morris. Hi Roz.
Hi Joanna.
And welcome back on the show. Is this number three?
It might be three. It might even be four.
Oh my goodness.
Yes.
That is pretty exciting. And I'll explain why in a minute, but just a little introduction if you missed the earlier episodes. Roz is the best-selling author of over a dozen novels as a ghostwriter and has also written My Memories of a Future Life and Life Form 3 under her own name. She has a series of books for writers under the Nail Your Novel brand. And the latest is Writing Plots with Drama, Depth and Heart. And the reason Roz is back on the show is the interview we did on Characters, which was the last Nail Your Novel book, was very popular. People loved it. And Roz writes brilliant books, but also great books for authors. So, Roz.
Yes.
Amazing. So, you know, we last talked episode 156, which was over a year ago now. Give us a bit of an update on you because, you know, you do lots and lots of stuff. A bit of an update on you and what you're up to creatively apart from these Nail Your Novel books.
Well, I've been doing all sorts of things. The most significant is I've begun teaching creative writing masterclasses for the Guardian newspaper in London. And that's great fun, very demanding. And something else that I find really, really rewarding about it is that I think I'm one of the only indie authors to be teaching writing craft for them.
Fantastic.
So, you know, that's a step forward for us all that, you know, indie authors are being recognised as people who write quality books.
Well done for doing that. And The Guardian, if people don't know, in the US, is a bastion of cultural kind of literary writing. So, yeah, that is a big coup.
And I've also been doing a radio show with a bookseller. So that's very interesting. Every week it's on a local radio station in Surrey, but you can pick it up on the internet. So it's just internet radio. Mm. And we talk every week about some aspect of writing and publishing. What else have I been doing? I'm teaching this year in various exotic locations, actually. Well, they're exotic to me because I don't travel very much. I just did a masterclass in Zurich and I'm doing one in Venice. Mm. And I think there's still a few spaces on that if people are interested. And so it's a day-long workshop. What else am I doing?
Writing a novel, I believe.
I am writing a novel. Yes, and that's the thing I wanted to get to last because it's the thing that you know, this is what it's all about. I'm writing another book that really matters to me. It's another novel that'll be literary, a bit strange, but another thing I really, really love is story. And story is you know the real heart of writing for me, and that is why I wrote the plot book actually because I wanted to really understand what a plot is and how we can write good plots no matter what genre we write.
Yeah, and well, and that's a good point because, I mean, that first, well, you had a bigger Nail Your Novel book and then the book on character. Now, as a you know, and this is ridiculous, obviously, but, you know, the literary fictions write character-based book and genre-based writers, you know, write plot-based books. What truth is there in that and what is plot anyway?
Well, at its simplest level, plot is what happens, just what happens. Story is what you do with it, because you could have events in a particular order. You don't have to tell them in the order they happened. You could have flashbacks, you could start in the middle, go back, then go forwards for the last half of the book, all sorts of things like that. So stories, understanding how to put your plot events in an order that is going to be most compelling and most interesting.
If it's what happened, so it's at, and you know, I know I'm trying to be quite specific here, is it what's happened in a physical sense? So what you're talking about doesn't include the interior life of the character, for example?
Well, it's good that you mentioned that, because this then comes down to questions of genre, because you could treat an event in loads of different ways. So if you have a murder, you could treat that in a very internalised way. So a character who is exploring the effects of a murder on them, the murder of someone they know. It may not matter at all whether the murder's ever solved or if the murderer is ever caught. On the other hand, if you're writing a more sort of a cozy mystery, it will matter that the murderer is caught, and it will be by the machinations of the particular characters who hold the world together. Cozy mystery is the tone of it is very important. So you've got one event, but it can be treated in a number of different ways. And what you said about internalizing and characters, that's just the focus that you have. So your focus as a writer will be the things you're interested in. If you are most interested in the characters and their minds and their emotions and their individual and very peculiar dilemmas, then you probably have a literary bent. If you're more interested in solving lots of puzzles in the events and all more those external kind of events, then you're more towards genre. Mm. Now, just because you're interested in one doesn't mean you can't be interested in the other. So we all are on a spectrum, an individual spectrum of how much of each we like to include.
Mm, which is interesting. And then again, on the, you know, just the basic definition of plots, you know, there's various books which are, you know, the seven plots that there are, or the three plots that everything is, or the hero's journey. You know, are there a certain number of plots that we deal with in books?
Well, there are probably certain scenarios that are always guaranteed to cause trouble. At its most simple, a story is about a struggle. And this is a mistake I see in a lot of manuscripts I edit, that somebody will present a sequence of events, but what they will have missed out is why it was worth telling it. And it was worth telling because the things that happened made difficulties for people. And the story is the struggle. It's not the events, it's the struggle. So you could say that there's really only one plot, and it's a struggle. You just look for struggle in lots of different guises, in lots of different situations. Mm. So various common situations, this is where you probably get to analysing them as three different plots or seven different plots. You could have things like revenge or a search or a need for redemption or a need to solve a puzzle. All that, those are very general human situations, and they're all quite emotional, but they're all about difficulties. And then you might mix the difficulties together. So if you want to thicken your plot a bit, you might add something like someone who wants revenge or someone who falls in love with the wrong person. So these are all things you can mix together to enrich your plot. But there's also the concept of the hero's journey, which is quite a common kind of plot, and it's actually very useful to think in those terms. There are a lot of stories that you could analyse in those terms. And all it is that a character leaves their ordinary life or is pushed out of their ordinary life. They enter a world of increasing challenges and difficulties. There are various steps in that Joseph Campbell described the hero's journey, or the monomyth, which was for him, you know, what all stories boiled down to. And he described a series of stages. So you had the belly of the whale, and this looks familiar to you.
The dark night of the soul.
All that, yes. And they're all stages that are useful to have, that stories have in common. It's helpful to know about these things because they can suggest things you should do with your plot, ways that you could make the difficulties greater for the characters. Mm. You don't have to include them all if you're following a hero's journey. Some of them may be completely irrelevant, such as confronting a monster, or returning victorious, but it's the idea of increasing challenges. And also another very important point is that there needs to be change. So you need to feel that whatever has happened during the course of the story, it will not all fall down again and be as it was before.
Something has to change. And it's so funny in reading your book and in talking to you now. And, you know, obviously I've prepared questions for this, but as we've done before, you realise and how much your book is incredibly dense with information. And, you know, a lot of writers listening will have read so many books on plot. And it's the question still comes up. Can't I just write a story without thinking of all this stuff? You know, can I not just write without a structure? So is it that pantser-plotter dichotomy, or, you know, what? Can a pantser really write a good story without thinking about all these details of plot, I guess is the question.
Well, I had a really interesting question in my Zurich course. Somebody put his hand up at the back when I'd been bombarding all day with stuff about theories of structure and three-act structure, which is basically just where you put your twists. He said, how did Shakespeare manage without knowing all this? Now, the thing is, good writers already have an innate sense. All the theories that we learn about writing are drawn from the things we naturally notice that we like about stories, and then the things that we learn that fill in our blind spots. So yes, there could come a point where you've kind of absorbed enough to find that most of it is innate, but you'll probably think you're pantsing, but actually you're probably noting the structure points in your head. You're probably looking for struggle quite naturally. You're probably thinking in incremental terms, thinking, how do I create change? How do I create a permanent change so that by the end of the story, people think, that it really is the end.
And I mean, I'm on my 10th fiction, 11th fiction project now, which is, you know, exciting. I think it's my 6th full-length novel now. And I have gone back again to look at plot and story structure, you know, once again revisiting this stuff, because I think it makes you stronger. So I really encourage people listening, like, this stuff, you know, you learn over and over again, don't you? I mean, you keep learning this stuff over and over again.
You do, and you learn also by the different ways people explain it to you. So one person's explanation might highlight one aspect, another person's explanation might make you think, I'd never realised that, but that makes perfect sense. So it reinforces what you know.
You have to think about it. So let's just get more specific. Let's just keep it simple, and it's a crime novel. You know, scene opens, dead body, main plot is we have to find the killer. It's a whodunit, basically. So, you know, that's a basic story. So the idea of cross genre, I mean, that is a very obvious genre novel with an easy to understand story arc. When we've got cross genre novels, how do we, you know, put those together as such?
Well, genre is all about meeting the reader's expectations. So people who want a crime novel will go looking for a crime novel, and you've got to make sure that whatever you do, it satisfies these certain points. If they think they're reading a crime novel and you actually deliver something that isn't, they'll just be dissatisfied. And so it's about meeting expectations. Now, there are certain kinds of genres that blend together really well. So romance goes well with almost anything. You can get thrillers to work very well with crime, because not all crime novels are thrillers. So certain things blend really well. Where it can be a problem is where you try to put together genres that don't blend together well, because they actually, their characteristics irritate the reader. So if you've got contemporary fiction, mostly readers of contemporary fiction like a world they can slip into very easily and not have to learn about. So if you then put it with historical or science fiction or fantasy, what you've done is give those readers something they're just irritated by. But people do this very successfully, and the trick to a cross-genre novel is to identify one genre that's going to be your primary genre, and you begin in that, so a contemporary novel. And then if you want to introduce something like somebody going back in time, Barbara Erskine does this in The Lady of Hay, which is
one of my favourite books,
But what she does is she introduces the historical parts in terms that won't irritate the readers of contemporary fiction. So they don't suddenly think, oh, she's suddenly gone off into a completely different kind of novel and I don't like this kind of detail. So that's how she handles it. Now, you do get writers who deliberately adopt different styles for hopping about between timelines, like David Mitchell in Cloud Atlas. Mm. But then that the reader has to be more willing to go along with that. And it's likely he irritated more people than he pleased. But then again, his novel was in a genre that allowed him to do that. So make sure the reader is prepared for what you're going to do.
Yeah, and a cross-genre novel is different to having subplots within the novel, right? Can you explain the difference between a plot and a subplot?
Well, really, it's a question of emphasis. Your main plot will be the things that are of major significance, major importance. Subplots tend to be there to support the main plot. They can highlight certain ideas so that it seems as though there are themes at work. They can give minor characters something to do that's interesting while we have a breather from the major plot. And having a breather from the major plot can be very useful because sometimes you get to a point where you've got the reader really on the edge of their seat and then you cut away to something else that they're still curious about, but you prolong the delicious tension a bit longer. Also, you can add changes of emotion so that if your main plot is very serious and very intense, you can have a subplot that's a bit lighter. And that just adds a welcome balance and lets the reader breathe a bit.
Mm. Shakespeare did that a lot, right?
Absolutely, yes. And he would have subplots that seem to have the same kind of forces at work. So jealousy in a main plot will be echoed by jealousy in a subplot, but it's not quite so intense. So that just gives you a sense of realism. Mm. Sometimes, though, people think they always need a subplot. You don't always need a subplot. Mm. There are plenty of books, plenty of novels that don't have subplots at all.
So Lee Child Jack Reacher. You know, one character just going through a sequence. You know, I don't think there's much of a subplot in a Lee Child novel.
Well, it would be more difficult anyway with first person because unless the character has two things going on, there just may not be room. You might clutter it if you have them doing too many other things. Mm. But if you felt the need for changes of pace or you felt that there were things that you wanted to do to make the book seem more real, you could add subplots going on, so the character's family doing something while the main character goes and finds the murderer.
Yeah, well, that's a good point. So point of view can constrain your plot ideas.
First person is actually very limited in a lot of ways. It's very good because it can make you very connected to the characters, and even if they're quite nasty, if you see from their point of view and you've only got their point of view, then it does draw you in a lot. On the other hand, there are lots of machinations you have to go through sometimes to show things that give the reader extra information.
I've never written, I'm thinking, I haven't written from a first person point of view, so you know, I did this and I did that. I suppose that's an interesting point. I haven't really thought about that. Thrillers are normally the third person type of, you know, you jump around, jump from place to place and head to head type of stuff.
Well, so one very good reason for that is in a thriller you have to feel the danger to the characters is real, and you know very well if you're first person that unless it's going to carry on after their death, they're not going to die.
that's a good point. So there are, I mean, when you actually think about these conventions, they are quite obvious if you know your genre. So, you know, if you're obviously we would assume that people writing in a genre would read heavily in that genre. And I consider literary fiction a genre as well. So, you know, people have to read in that and understand how the conventions work. OK, so in the book you have the four C's of a good plot. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Yes. OK, they are curiosity, crescendo, coherence, and change. So curiosity, it's fairly self-evident actually. You just want the reader to be curious all the time. You do not want to let go of their curiosity. So you've always got to have something that feels like it's bubbling along. There's another bit to know and another bit to know. Crescendo, you have to feel like everything is increasing in intensity, that that the characters are getting into more trouble, that the events matter a bit more. And these may be tiny, tiny steps, but you just need to create this feeling of movement towards something more important all the time. Coherence. Now, good plots, well, indeed good stories, seem to have a sense that everything belongs together. When you put it down at the end, you feel like you've seen a whole pattern in some way, and that makes a book seem very elegant and well crafted. So that's where themes can be useful, because you can have your main characters enacting, say, some form of jealousy, and your subplot characters doing something similar, but it seems to belong together. And so this coherence is very important. And another point about coherence is, if you plant events or characters in the early part of the book, the more you can tie everything together, then the more satisfying it will seem to be. So that's where you might have an ending where you will bring back something and the reader will think, it was there all along. And that is so satisfying. And this is all about, so this all comes under the idea of coherence. Try and make the plot as coherent as possible. And the final point was change. As I said at the beginning, you have to feel that something irrevocable has happened and that a lot of change has been gone through by the characters, and that by the end it can't be undone. And that makes you feel like it was a satisfying journey. And all plots, no matter what style you're writing, what genre you're writing, they will all have these characteristics, unless you're deliberately trying to do something that is anti-plot. And in that case, well, it probably is still useful to know about those things because you'd want to avoid them.
No, that's really handy. And when you talk about coherence, it's funny, the first thing that springs to mind is Game of Thrones, which has kind of lost coherence in the books. You know, after kind of book three, book four, it's become quite difficult to keep that. And I wonder if you have any tips around, obviously George R. R. Martin is a genius and all that, but do you have any tips for the kind of a multi-book series plot for the things that you've talked about there? I mean, you know, because the curiosity, for example, would have to, you know, you have to keep some hooks for the longer term, and the coherence, you know, very difficult to do over lots and lots of books. Do you have any tips for that?
Well, it is very difficult to create a good story that will keep going over so long, because you'll have to be delivering situations that seem to be endings and resolutions, and that you're only going to be able to come up with so many of those. The best examples are actually in the long-running, and I think at the moment, are in the long-running American TV shows like Breaking Bad, where they've got teams of writers who are really busting their guts to make sure that they deliver a good story. And you end up with something that I think each series might amount to about 19 hours. But it's a hell of a job to try and get enough good story and keep the surprises coming. And of course, because the characters change a lot, they should change a lot throughout the course of the stories, there's only so far you can take them. They probably can't go through very much more change. But this is why with novel series, what tended to happen was you would have characters who wouldn't change very much. They couldn't. So that meant they had the longevity. James Bond, for instance, he's affected by things that happen, but he doesn't really change very much. Things happen around him. He makes things change. But so that would be one tip, to have somebody who's always going to be a centre of it, who won't change very much and change everything else around them. But also, just don't go on too long. If you feel that it doesn't have any more life in it, then it's not really writing a good, you won't really be writing good books anymore. not welcome.
Yeah, and yeah, it's fascinating. I'm really thinking about another series. And I think maybe it'll be a trilogy. I think three books is as much as I can hold in my head in terms of a story. You know, when you think my Arcane series, I designed episodically, as you said, like the main, you know, things happen, so they solve new mysteries. So that's okay. But in terms of a story arc across multiple books, three books to me seems like enough.
Well, each writer has their own limit as well. So if three books is what you can keep in your head and what you can incrementally plot and keep the satisfying surprises coming and keep everything going, then three books is your personal length. You know, it's like marathons. Some people can run marathons. Some people can run ultra marathons. Mm. And some people can only do a sprint. Mm. So it's
very... go for a walk.
Yes, sorry. but yeah, it's a question of personal stamina as well.
Yeah, and I know this is kind of off topic, but the stamina thing is a big deal as a fiction writer. This is something I've learned. I know you've been doing it a lot longer than me, but it's hard work, right? It's really hard work, and this kind of plotting stuff is the work almost.
There's a lot of work that goes into getting it right. There's the plotting, there's making sure you've got the characters who have got the kind of mileage in them to take you all the way through the book, and making sure you've got an idea that you can make enough of without having to add loads of other stuff. You know, we're talking about coherence. If everything seems to just belong together, it just looks better. It looks like a more clever book and it's more memorable. But if it's something that a lot of novice writers do is they just heap in more and more and more ideas and they just end up with a mess.
Yeah. Okay, so let's talking about a mess. On my last book that I wrote, Delirium, in the London Psychic series, like last year, I got into the theme so much, the theme being madness, you know, delirium, madness. And I got so much into the theme and the research around madness in London and the history of psychiatry that I kind of lost the plot. So how and when do we use themes within a plot?
Well, themes, as I said, add to your coherence. They add to the sense that the book is about more than just the story. But you have to be quite disciplined about how you use it. One mistake that some writers do make is they have a lot of scenes that are meant to illustrate the theme, but they forget to have anything happen.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of let the themes maybe suggest things. But if you're writing a book and you haven't yet decided its theme, don't worry, because what you might find is it emerges as you edit, as you start to see patterns. But really, themes are patterns for the readers to notice. It doesn't matter so much if you haven't noticed them. Now, I know exactly what you mean about getting involved in research and your subject and going up a lot of blind alleyways. Did you find you were writing bits where nothing much was happening? How did you stop yourself? Did you notice?
I cut out a lot. What ended up happening was, like, goodness me, there's a long, you know, my character is talking a lot about her interpretation of what all of this means, which is not the, you know, which is not the role of the character. The character should not do a long soliloquy about madness.
Especially if that breaks the style of the rest of the
book. Yeah, exactly. So I would just cut all of that out and then try to, you know, show, don't tell. And instead, you know, actually have a scene set in a location that might illustrate that point, for example.
Yeah, yeah. So you've got to try and make your fascinating study into actual scenes. Now, if you use them to inspire what happens in the book, that's great. But you can go up blind alleyways with it's like research. It's like doing too much research. They are close cousins, actually. You start reading around stuff and then you just get lost forever.
But that's part of the fun. You know, I love research. So, and, you know, my stories emerge from research rather than me deciding on something and then, you know, doing it that way. But another thing that people, you know, my theme thing is similar to backstory. Like, people will info dump backstory, and I've noticed this the book I'm writing now, Deviance, the next one, my first chapter is super long and I've just info dumped because I'm working out my own backstory, and then I've got to remember to move it out of the first chapter somewhere else. So what are some of the other issues with backstory and plot?
Well, that's the major issue with backstory, that writers dump it in at the beginning and it's as if to understand how this appears to a reader, just imagine somebody says, well, I'm going to tell you what happened this morning, but before I tell you that, I'm going to tell you this. And you switched off immediately because you want to know about the interesting thing that happened this morning. So with backstory, you have to get the reader curious enough that they'll welcome quite a lot of it. And that usually happens after quite a long time. Again, if you think of somebody you know, you probably did not know much about their backstory until you'd known them for quite a while. Mm. And even if they told you, you probably didn't listen until you'd got to know them quite a while. And then there would have been a quiet sort of evening where you were sitting down and you said, so how did you end up with this man or whatever, and end up writing? And then the story is keenly paid attention to. Mm. So that's one point about backstory. You have to deploy it at a point where the reader is really curious. And another point about backstory is that a lot of writers invent really good backstory and then find they haven't got anything for the characters to do during the actual story.
Do you then move the story backwards in time?
You could, yeah, because they probably started it in the wrong place. Mm. And what they had was all these events, and they didn't realise they actually did have a really good story. And they'd invented it quite naturally, thinking, oh, well, the character could have had this happen and this happen. So they either could, as you say, wind back time back and start the story earlier, or think about how to just move the events so that they happen while the reader is experiencing the characters' lives. Mm. So that's something that I see a lot. Really good events buried in backstory. And all you need to do is have the courage to take them out and work out how to work to massage them into the actual front story.
Or write a novella about that character that is a
separate, oh yes, yes, thing. Use it in that way. Yes.
Yeah, Then in terms of the series thing, another question about backstory with a series, which is a bit of a nightmare. So again, writing Deviants at the moment, there's a character that appeared in book one, and in book three, I have to, this, if you read book one, you'd know this character, but I need to reintroduce the character and describe a little bit about how they met the first time and what she was doing. You know, she's like a tattooed exotic dancer with this full body octopus tattoo, which is cool. And I need to explain that somehow and how that happened. So how much of that is that called backstory, or how much do we have to do that in a series to update on the previous books in the series?
Well, you could either, I think some writers just rely on the fact that the previous books have been read and they don't bother. But the more kind way to do it is to find a way of getting it in. And I used to have to do this because I wrote a series, and I used to have to find a way always of getting in the backstory of how the characters had met, what they thought of each other. So what I'd do is I would find a scene where they were involved in something exciting, but there was something, as the reader was being introduced to the characters, there was something I could pick out that would say, ah, oh, so-and-so did their typical thing. It was like this. So-and-so did their typical thing. So that it reintroduced the characters. And then a little bit later, when there was a bit of a lull, I was able to say, they had all met at this time and this happened and now they were forged together as a team and that sort of thing. So I found ways to slip it in, but I made it appear new. But also so that people who were fans of the series would think, ah, oh, yes, it's nice to see that would be included again. Yeah, that thing again. And
it's a real balance because, of course, you know, you want readers to join whatever and be able to read a book in entirety without knowing that stuff. But equally, you want to reward the readers who've stuck around with the kind of in-joke type of thing, don't you? You want to balance that.
Yes, and it does become increasingly difficult to find innovative ways to do that.
Because you can't even use the same sentence structure or the same wording because they may have just read the other book before that.
Yeah, yeah. But I think they will accept it more if you've had an exciting bit and then the characters obviously have to have a bit of a lull where, say, they go back and regroup at headquarters, and then as they're going back there, you can slip it in and the reader doesn't notice it so acutely.
Mm. Okay, so we also hear, and these are massive topics that we can do a podcast on each, and of course everyone will buy Roz's book, but we hear about conflict. Now, you know, I'm a thriller writer, so conflict for me can be blowing stuff up and people fighting. You know, in your memories of a future life, for example, if you'd have just blown something up in the middle, that probably wouldn't have been so, you know, allowed in the genre. So how you know, what is conflict in the case of plot?
Well, conflict is basically just things that make life difficult for the characters. That's all it is. And remember at the beginning I said how the story is the struggle. Mm. Are you beginning to see immediately that any struggle could be part of the story?
Okay, you didn't include conflict as a C. It's the fifth C.
I could have. Yes, I probably had. Oh, damn.
Yeah,
what, I'm just looking at my notes. What did I have? Crescendo, change. Well, yeah, I suppose so. Yeah,
sorry,
okay, that is the fifth
conflict.
C. It is the fifth C. So anyway, the story is struggle. And there are various broad areas where we can look for conflict. So you've got the hero versus themselves. So that might be a fear or something they have to avenge. You can have the hero versus society, or the hero versus nature or the environment, or the hero versus other characters. All these parts, these are all parts of any normal person's life. You know, they're all surrounded by a mixture of these things. And all these factors can create difficulties for them that will add to the story. And what writers often fail to do if they're just starting out is explore different areas of conflict enough. So they might have their characters trying to hunt down a nuclear bomb, but what they'll forget is that the individuals in their team will all have different opinions about how to do things. Someone who might actually be working for a different government and is there in secret and undercover, and all these different agendas will complicate matters and make it far more difficult to just find the bomb they were looking for in the first place. So you have to look for ways in which you can keep the difficulty level going. And that's one of the things also that keeps readers curious, because they think, oh, but there's this. Oh, but there's this. And I can see it's not going to be straightforward.
Mm. And that conflict, you know, can be obviously other people conflict is one thing, but the internal conflict is something that's quite big as well, right? And can weave into backstory, I suppose.
Yes, yes, it can be. It can be backstory. It can be just personality as well. So if it was backstory, it might be somebody who the main character couldn't forgive but is forced to work with.
Hmm.
If it was their own personality, it could be a fear, or it could be some coping mechanism that they have developed, but that makes them very vulnerable in other ways, because they might be hiding something very deep. But again, that depends on the scope of your novel. So you mentioned My Memories of a Future Life, which is, it's quite literary, and it's about a character who is trying to overcome an injury, but before she can do that, she actually has to unravel a lot about her past. And this is why she does this thing with the hypnosis. But her struggles and her conflicts are more internal, though she does also have people she's fighting against, because they've got different agendas from her. They're pushing her in directions that she's very unhappy about. So there's a lot of conflict in there.
Mm. And the other conflict I always like is the man versus nature kind of bigger conflict. I'd like to write something like that, you know, where, you know, it's the like Noah and the flood. It's like a man mm-hmm. versus nature, or God, whatever you want to call that type of story. I mean, you know, is that a good one? I mean, there's a lot of movies about that, isn't there?
Yes, and it's more difficult to make it work in prose if you're thinking of disaster movies.
Mm.
And they are very cinematic, and they can be so disorientating to read about in prose that it's difficult to make them work. However, I'm reading a novel at the moment, and I can't remember the name of the author. It's translated from German, and it's called Night Work, and it's about a man who wakes up and discovers everyone has vanished.
Mm.
Everything still works. Electricity still works. And but the phones all seem to be disconnected, and there is not one other living soul. And he becomes just pitted against this in this I guess, this really strange environment where all of humanity has gone.
Mm. It's not a rapture book, is it?
No. It's a standalone novel. But it's really tense.
Yeah.
Because you don't know what he's going to do next. And he is pitted against nature and also this force of loneliness. It's a very strange book.
Yeah, well, anyway, conflict. We can't go into everything in massive detail. So I also wanted to ask about endings, because endings, I mean, like, I love Stephen King, for example, but he's well known for getting some endings, like, really badly wrong. Like, the one I really think of is Under the Dome, which I won't spoil for anyone, but the ending, you're just like, what? That's ridiculous. Whereas, you know, the rest of the book is really strong. And then the ending is like, oh, no, wrong choice, mate. But of course, I would never criticise the master, Stephen King. But when, you know, how do endings go wrong, and how do we make sure that ending works and is satisfying to the reader?
Well, usually a story will have posed a question of some sort. So it will be, can this be found? Can this person recover? Can they get vengeance? Can they get to the end of their quest? You've got to make sure that whatever questions you've set up are answered in some way. Now, there's what I call the ending that belongs to the characters. And there's also another way of looking at endings, which is the ending that belongs to the reader, which is more of a literary device. But the ending that belongs to the characters is, did they solve all the things? Can they go on to their lives? Have we seen everything settled? There's a new order and everything. But the ending that's more for the reader will be to leave them with a feeling. So if you've got something like like Lord of the Flies by William Golding, you've got a group of boys on a desert island and they've all gone feral. At the end, they're rescued. And the final scene is on the beach. The rescuer is a man in a navy uniform. And at that point, one of the main characters sort of sees him burst into tears because he just realises what he's been through. And it ends there. We do not follow the characters into their lives. We don't find out how they settled down, found nice families and were happy again. We end on the beach with this realisation of what's been seen, what they've gone through, and the complete disintegration of civilization. And that's an ending for the reader because it resonates in the reader and they go away and think about it. So that's one extreme. But if you were to tell that story in a more conventional adventure way, then you would have them rescued, you'd have it taken off, you'd have someone saying, oh, that island you found, well, it's here, you can see it now. And we're all kind of normalising and getting back to normal. And that was more about, that would be more about solving the puzzles. So these are two extreme ways of giving an ending, two endings for one story, really. Mm. So you have to consider what you've made the reader interested in. If you've made the reader interested in the disintegration of civilization, then the disintegration of civilization is a good thing to end on, or just some way in which it is being changed. Mm. If you've made them interested in how will they get out, how will they find the device that's going to blow up the world, how will they win the war, then you must end with that question being solved. So what Stephen King, I haven't read that book, but what he might have done was set something up and you were more interested in that being resolved than what he actually resolved.
He basically switched genres in the last 5% of the book, which is confusing. And I think that's really important. You know, if you're going to write, you know, you can't write a contemporary set novel which is three quarters of the way set in normal London with normal people and then, you know, slam in like a fairy in the last 5%, for example.
I think we call that an ass-pull.
Oh, do we? Yeah,
just inventing something that you didn't have in before. And another way in which you know your ending has gone wrong is if you have to have screeds of explanation in order to make it work, because your ending comes out of what you've been knitting into the text all the way through. Now, if he'd had the fairies all the way through, it might have worked.
Exactly. Or, so for me, like, yes, on Monday, we're recording on Wednesday, so I've been struggling with Deviance because I didn't know how it's going to end. Like, I had one idea of how it would end, but I really couldn't write the book because I didn't know how it's going to end. And I'm someone who I need to know the ending before I write the rest of the plot. So now I know the ending, like you say, I can now scatter in things that will make the ending right.
Yes.
You know, at that point. But you have to go back and kind of seed that earlier so that people think it's inevitable, but still surprising.
Absolutely. They have to be surprising and inevitable. Mm. That's what a good ending is. But it's got to seem fair. Because if you just suddenly fling something in that the reader didn't know about, they know you just invented it on the spot.
Mm. I do want to write a techno thriller called Deus Ex Machina. And just make it, you know, just pull it all out. I think that would be fun. Okay, so, you know, we're running out of time, but I wonder if you could give us an overview of your plotting process for one of your books. And obviously every author is different, but you're a literary writer, but you still have a pretty hardcore plotting process. So maybe you could talk about that.
I do, and I do a lot of shuffling about of events. So what I do is I first of all have usually a situation where I think this is provocative in some way. So with my memories of future life, it was somebody going to another life through hypnosis, and I thought, who'd do that? So I start to think about characters who would be the most sorely tried by whatever it is I'm cooking up. And I'd explore all the people who I could get involved who would be interesting to watch. It's the people be interesting to watch. You want people who will be really challenging their comfort zones, struggles all the way. And then I start to piece together what they might do. And I research and I find things that are maybe suggested by, like you, with the kind of world they're in, things that could happen, historical events that might be useful. And I build up a set of events. Mm. And then I start writing, and I usually swap them around quite a bit because I feel more natural ways for the events to happen. I also have to work out what my ending is going to be, what kind of resolution I'm looking for. And write towards that, and then I put it away, then I bring it out again, analyse it all in depth with the beat sheet, which is one of my tools in the original Nailor novel that we talked about on our course. And what that lets me do is just look at the story flow. And then I go into it again, and I start looking for much better ways to use the events that I've got, because in my first draft they're probably a bit anemic and I haven't really utilised them to the max. But I love stories. I love keeping the reader gripped page by page, making them think, what's going to happen? This person is getting in a worse situation. And so I look for that all the time. And then I just go through the book looking for ways to make things worse.
Mm. You know, I'll link to the beat sheet thing in the show notes so people can find that. You know, you've got a lot on your websites and in the book, of course, about your plotting process. So I think people should have a look at that. But it is important to kind of remember that everyone does it differently. And you use physical cards, don't you? Oh, got some.
I have. This is Everest, the novel that I'm doing my second draft of now.
That's the one that you used to call The Mountains?
Yes. Okay. That was a little trick for me, because until I'd found the ending, until I got to the end of the first draft, I felt there was something I wanted to keep back. I had actually named it, but I wanted to keep it back until I felt confident enough to say, okay, I have an ending on it. It will have a beginning, a middle, and an end. And now I feel I can reveal what it's really called. It's just a silly thing to give me a milestone. Once I was able to reveal what it was called, then I felt like I understood it better.
Mm. And this is totally off our topic, but titles, I am so struggling with titles at the moment. I'm questioning everything I ever knew about titles, and I'm retitling some of my books. And this is something of freedom as indies that we have to retitle. But when I'm writing the first draft, and I've had loads of titles for all of my books, as I'm writing, my titles change. So was the mountains book what you would call a working title, and do you always have two different, you know, a working title and a finished title, or, you know, do you have any tips for titling books, because I think it's damn hard?
Oh, it's really difficult. The title will tell you something about the novel's genre. So if you're struggling to title your book, the best thing to do is to look up books that are like it and just see the kind of language that's used in the title. Because one of the possible titles that I had for Ever Rest, which is what I'm actually calling it, was Comeback.
Sounds like a thriller, more like
exactly.
a thriller crime, yeah.
Exactly. Now, it would work within its own world. It would work to call it Comeback, but that wouldn't be right for it.
Like a movie as well, like a shoot 'em up movie.
There are loads of books and movies called Comeback. That's another problem. And also, I found I couldn't even remember it. What's it called? Countdown? Couldn't remember it myself, so that wasn't going to be any good. So there's got to be a title's got to set up expectations. It's also, I think, got to set up a kind of frisson, the kind of a promise that makes the reader think, I've got to look a bit more closely at that.
This is something I want to do talk more about titles. I think I think it's something that is under talked about in general and not really written about, you know, especially for indies, because I think when you are writing the book, you put a title on your working draft and your manuscript. When you're typing it, it has a file name, so you have to create it with a file name, so you're already thinking about titles. And yet when you've written the book, sometimes that doesn't work. You know, it will change. And I think we don't have enough direction really around titles. I mean, you've worked in traditional publishing a lot. You know, how do they do it? I mean, they're obviously, the writer doesn't get the choice there.
No, it's a marketing decision. And the marketing department and the editor will talk about whether they like your title.
Does the writer very often not get their choice?
Well, it depends. Sometimes the writer's made the perfect choice, and it also depends on the genre they're writing. If they're literary writers, then it's more a question of personal expression. That's so what the author would choose to call the book would be respected more, I think. If it's genre, then if the author's sort of got the wrong title, then they'll be given quite a lot of help to find a right one.
So fascinating. We might come back to this topic at another point. You know, there's a little extra bit there. So, Roz, tell people again the title of the book, where people can find it, and where they can find all your other books online.
Okay, this latest one is called Writing Plots with Drama, Depth and Heart, Nail Your Novel 3. And the easiest place to find it is if you go to www.nailyournovel.com, and there are tabs there that will guide you to those books. And if you're interested in my fiction, you'll also be able to find it from there too.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time, Roz. That was great.
Thank you. That was fun.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at thecreativepen or find me on Facebook at thecreativepen. See you next time.